revolutions and unique in having weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East.
Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM.
Oh, Jesus.
Santa Cruz.
96.3 on your radio dial.
Radio, and it filled the airwaves with stuff you wouldn't normally hear.
It says, screw the FCC.
Moses is when his snake ate the other two and swallowed them.
Weston, you come to me and I'll take care of it for you.
All right, well, thank you, Officer Stan.
We'll
all right, you guys, take it easy. Officer Martin, 96.3 Freak Radio. Well, I guess it's okay to sit on this little sidewalk. You're okay. You're not violating the law there.
The United States has patiently worked to preserve UNSCOM as Iraq has sought to avoid its obligation to cooperate with the inspectors. On occasion, we've had to threaten military force, and Saddam has backed down. Faced with Saddam's latest act of defiance...
As President Clinton made his case on December 16th for the U.S. and British bombings of Iraq, claiming that the Iraqi government had not cooperated with UNSCOM, the UN inspection team, people around the world protested, condemning the military action. In San Francisco, peace activist Tawny Stair said at a rally that Clinton's justification for the U.S.-British attacks was a lie. In fact, out of 400 inspections in the month leading up to the bombings, Iraq had raised objections only 5 times. One of those incidents involved questioning of university students.
The United States' true interest in Iraq, no matter how many different issues and sides of this war that we hear in the next couple of days, the United States' interest in Iraq is to dominate the Middle East and the oil-rich region of the Middle East and of Iraq. Iraq was the number 2 oil producer in the world prior to the sanctions in the Gulf War. Number 2! And who has that share of the oil today? Who has that share of the oil market? It's the United States and Saudi Arabia.
Another activist, Nancy Mitchell, dismissed efforts by the U.S. government, widely promulgated by the U.S. corporate media, to demonize Iraqi President Saddam Hussein.
Iraq really has not threatened U.S. national security at all. The U.S. media has been really successful in scaring the whole U.S. public about some maniac Saddam Hussein. In fact, you know, the Iraqi leadership, In the 1970s, they nationalized their oil, and they actually were able to use those what would normally have been profits for Shell and Exxon, etc., to provide free health care for their people, provide free education through the university level, something that we don't have in this country, of course. So I think that the threat that, you know, really the most threatening thing that Saddam Hussein or the Ba'ath Party leadership has done is to nationalize that oil and take those profits away from U.S. big business.
But Saddam Hussein has ruthlessly suppressed political opponents, and the Iraqi president gassed the Kurds in Iraq when he was a U.S. ally in the late 1980s. Nonetheless, the Iraqi people enjoyed one of the highest standards of living in the developing world prior to the 1991 Gulf War. Trade sanctions imposed on Iraq after the war have decimated the society. The United Nations estimates that 5,000 to 6,000 children die each month as a result of the sanctions. Former head of the UN's Oil for Food program for Iraq, Dennis Halliday, resigned from his post in September 1998 in protest of the continued sanctions. Activist Nancy Mitchell recently returned from Iraq, and she describes the suffering she saw there.
You know, I've seen a lot of video because we sent other delegations to Iraq, and I'd seen some of the most horrific images, you know, children that are totally malnourished, dying from simple things like mumps, measles, things that they never thought would exist in their country again. So I'd seen that, but it was sort of the more subtle things that really struck me and were so painful to see, like the fact that the children that aren't dying in hospitals, they try to go to school, but they can only go to school for 3 hours at a time now. They used to go for like a normal day like we would in the West. But they can only go for 3 hours because they can't concentrate. Not only are they malnourished, but the whole society has been completely traumatized. And it's almost as if they just can't continue a normal course, you know? And I mean, aside from the fact that like 1.6 million people have died, and that is a UN figure.
I hope Saddam will come into cooperation with the inspection system now and comply with the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. But we have to be prepared that he will not. And we must deal with the very real danger he poses.
President Clinton argued that Iraq had failed to follow UN Security Council resolutions and was therefore subject to punitive and deadly action. But how does this standard apply when we consider the U.S. government's own track record? The Clinton administration claims that it had the right to strike Iraq without Security Council approval because it already had standing approval since the ceasefire after the Gulf War in 1991. Michael Ratner is an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York and author of a forthcoming article in the American Journal of International Law titled Bypassing the Security Council, Use of Force in the Iraqi Inspection Regime.
That's a remarkable statement by the U.S. and Albright, whoever's making that statement. If you want to look at the history of those resolutions, there was the first resolution which allowed us to use force. That's Resolution 678. It said we could use any means necessary to oust Iraq from Kuwait. There was then 687, which is what the U.S. is referring to, which is the ceasefire resolution, and that ended the hostilities, and that does say that Iraq is to comply with inspections. The question then becomes, let's say Iraq isn't complying with inspections. Whose authority is to determine that they're not complying and what action should be taken? The ceasefire was entered by the United Nations Security Council with Iraq. It goes back to the Security Council for any violations of the ceasefire. The Security Council then has to decide what's the appropriate remedy for violations of the ceasefire. And over the last 7 years, the United States has consistently gone to the Security Council and tried to get the authority to use bombings because of alleged Iraqi violations of the inspection regime. They have never gotten that authority from the Security Council. The Security Council has said, yes, there was violations of the ceasefires and of the inspection regime, but they have never said you can use force to do it, and they've never used the magic words. The magic words when it comes to a violation of a ceasefire are that the other side, Iraq in this case, has materially breached the ceasefire. Or the inspection regime in this case.
Ratner adds that the member nations voting on a resolution in February 1998 expressly said that the resolution did not give authority to bomb Iraq for violations of what he termed the inspection regime. Furthermore, Ratner says that Clinton's decision to bomb Iraq without approval from Congress constitutes an impeachable offense.
Well, there's no issue that the unilateral bombing by the president without going to our Congress for authority violates really the most fundamental tenet of our Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution basically says that before you go to war, Congress has to declare war, and the President can't do it on his own. And this is considered a war under our Constitution. That clause was meant to get big wars and small wars. Serious military attacks like this one would certainly be within it. Had he gone to Congress and gotten a vote, and he didn't have to get a vote the day before the bombing, it could have gotten a vote a month ago that said that if Iraq violates the inspection regime, you can use force. It could have still gotten a vote and gotten a surprise attack against Iraq.
We must be prepared to use force again if Saddam takes threatening actions, such as trying to reconstitute its weapons of mass destruction, all their delivery systems, threatening his neighbors, challenging Allied aircraft over Iraq, or moving against his own Kurdish citizens. The credible threat to use force, and when necessary, the actual use of force, is the surest way to contain Saddam's weapons of mass destruction program, curtail his aggression, and prevent another Gulf War.
U.S. officials have made a lot of fuss about protecting Iraq's neighbors from Saddam Hussein, but recent history reveals that the United States has had a direct role in arming Iraq and simultaneously arming its enemies. One example is the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. Journalist Dennis Bernstein.
The U.S. government had made a national security decision to arm Iraq. Weapons are a big business. So all our weapons defense contractors and related contractors who build U.S. weapons arsenals participated in helping the Iraqis. You could say that George Bush was a key advisor to Saddam Hussein from 1985 to 1990. We're talking about him carrying over military intelligence. We're talking about technical advice coming from U.S. corporations on how to deal with Iran, how to target better Iran. We're talking about George Bush arriving with various kinds of intelligence like this. U.S. corporations provided billions of dollars in technology to the Iraqis for the creation of chemical, nuclear, and biological weapons of mass destruction. Just about every defense company or anything participated on the part of the U.S. Honeywell, Hewlett-Packard, international imaging systems. They gave imaging technology for computers for missile programs, Tektronix computer graphic terminals for Iraqi missile centers. We're talking about vacuum pumps and bellows for nuclear weapons plants, and on this policy went up, as I said, until right before the Gulf War. By the way, the policy continued even after intelligence came in that the Iraqis were using weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, biological weapons against the Kurds and against the Iranians.
During the 1980s, the United States was also supplying anti-aircraft missiles to Iran in operations that became part of the Iran-Contra affair. U.S. officials also like to take a high moral stance when it comes to protecting the Kurds from Saddam Hussein. But as it turns out, the United States is currently arming Turkey.
Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, on your 96.3 FM, at your 96.3 FM, FMB, it's Free Radio Santa Cruz, FRSC. I'm your host, Bathroom Spear Robert Morris. Stay with me for 2.5 hours, maybe more, of Civil Rights for the Poor. We've got lots of tapes today. Hope you'll call in. Give us a call at 427-3772, and stay with us.
Santa Cruz, and
grab yourself a telephone to Roosevelt next to, and let us know what you think of what's going on here, what's going on in your community. The show concerns itself mostly with the impact of Santa Cruz laws, police policies, and the actions of different organizations around poor people. That is to say, most of us out there who aren't comfortably situated in gated communities. I'm your host, Bathrobe's Pierre Robert Morris. I'm going to be with you for the next 2.5 hours. We're going to be playing a number of interviews that I've run through in the last week or two, plus some recordings at public meetings like the Citizens Police Review Board, which had quite a tempestuous meeting on Monday when they reconvened and had a second vote on the issue of an independent investigation in the May 22nd police versus the protesters events outside the McPherson Center around the Yugoslav war, the war against the Yugoslavians that President Clinton and his NATO buddies have been conducting and have won, I guess, subsequently, and that they have now occupied Kosovo and indeed seem to be stopping the Russians from coming in as well. That's all in the name of human rights. But here in Santa Cruz, of course, the question was human rights for people subjected to police misconduct as we perceived it, and I count myself among those who perceived police misconduct on that occasion. We had 5 people arrested, more people brutalized, and just a general wrong-headed approach to police behavior and how to handle a protest. And we're hoping that there will be some independent investigation of that. It has, in fact, been authorized. And Arnie Leff, the chair of the Citizens Police Review Board, is presumably conferring with his staff members to get a hold of an independent investigator. And if anybody has suggestions about professional investigators they think would be useful, I think Leff is open to suggestion from all sides. He wants a fair investigation, as he describes it. We met with him on Friday, a number of us, to chat with him about the issue. Anybody can meet with the Citizens Police Review Board members. They are your public representatives on that board, which is supposed to be overseeing the Santa Cruz Police Department. And presumably, for the first time in its history, they will now have an independent investigator appointed to do an early investigation. That's actually 2 precedents have been set. One is for an independent investigator, and the second is for an early independent investigation. The point being that if you wait until the Internal Affairs Department and then the court cases are settled, you might be getting rather old before you actually heard anything about what actually happened in these cases. And the cases that we're talking about, for those of you who don't know, have to do with Officer David LeFevre's behavior regarding 2 parents with children, presumably the actions of other police officers as well, but certainly Officer David LeFevre, and the question of the charges levied against protesters, including that against Steve Argue, currently out on $20,000 bail for punching a police officer. Argue explained, and supporters agree with him, that he used necessary force to stop LeFevre from torturing a woman named Julianne and dragging her dangerously into traffic rather than cooling off the situation. LeFevre seemed to be testosterone-driven and heating it up. And that is the claim of the different protesters who saw that, or a number of them, as well as some witnesses who weren't protesters at all. And there were numerous video accounts of what happened. In fact, you can see some of those video films if you're interested by going into the Citizens Police Review Board. Monday's a holiday, but Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, they're open every day, 9 to 1, 915 Cedar Street, if anybody wants to go in and take a look at that stuff. Now I think we're going to have a little... Is this the time for this? I'm not sure. Yeah, let's begin with a comic break. That way the rest of the show will hopefully stand in marked contrast. Here's a little from George Carlin's latest album. Not the best quality, Carlin, as far as I can see generally, but this particular bit I enjoyed, so perhaps you will too.
Airport security is a stupid idea, it's a waste of money, and it's only there for one reason, to make white people feel safe. That's all. The illusion. The feeling and illusion of safety to placate the middle class, because the authorities know they can't make an airplane completely safe. Too many people have access. You'll notice the drug smugglers don't seem to have a lot of trouble getting their little packages on board, do they? No, and God bless them too. Yes. Oh, and by the way, an airplane flight shouldn't be completely safe. You need a little danger in your life. Take a fucking chance once in a while, will you? What are you gonna do, play with your prick for another 30 years? What, are you going to read People magazine and eat at Wendy's till the end of time? Take a fucking chance. Besides, even if they made all of the airplanes completely safe, the terrorists would simply start bombing other places that are crowded. Porn shops, crack houses, titty bars, and gangbangs. You know, entertainment venues. The odds of you being killed by a terrorist are practically zero. So I say relax and enjoy the show. You have to be a realist. You have to be realistic about terrorism. Certain groups of people, certain groups, Muslim fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, Jewish fundamentalists, and just plain guys from Montana, are going to continue to make life in this country very interesting for a long, long time. That's the reality. Angry men in combat fatigues talking to God on a two-way radio and muttering incoherent slogans about freedom are eventually going to provide us with a great deal of entertainment. Especially after your stupid fucking economy collapses all around you and the terrorists come out of the woodwork. You'll have anthrax in the water supply, the sarin gas in your air conditioners, there'll be chemical and biological suitcase bombs in every city, and I say enjoy it. Relax. Enjoy the show. Take a fucking chance. Put a little fun in your life. To me, terrorism is exciting. It's exciting. I think the very idea that you can set off a bomb in a marketplace and kill several hundred people is exciting and stimulating, and I see it as a form of entertainment. Entertainment, that's all it is. Yeah. But I also know that most Americans are soft and frightened and unimaginative, and they don't realize there's such a thing as dangerous fun. And they certainly don't recognize a good show when they see one. I have always been willing to put myself at great personal risk for the sake of entertainment. And I've always been willing to put you at great personal risk for the same reason. As far as I'm concerned, all of this airport security, all the searches, the screenings, the cameras, the questions, it's just one more way of reducing your liberty and reminding you that they can fuck with you anytime they want, as long as you put up with it. As long as you put up with it. Which means, of course, anytime they want. Because that's what Americans do now. They're always willing to trade away a little of their freedom in exchange for the feeling, the illusion of security. What we have now is a completely neurotic population obsessed with security and safety and crime and drugs and cleanliness and hygiene and germs. There's another thing, germs. Where did this sudden fear of germs come from in this country? Have you noticed this? The media, constantly running stories about all the latest infections, salmonella, E. coli, hantavirus, bird flu, and Americans panic easily, so now everybody's running around, scrubbing this and spraying that, and overcooking their food and repeatedly washing their hands, trying to avoid all contact with germs. It's ridiculous, and it goes to ridiculous lengths. In prisons, before they give you a lethal injection, they swab your arm with alcohol. It's true. It's true. It's true. Well, they don't want you to get an infection. And you can see their point. Wouldn't want some guy to go to hell and be sick. It would take a lot of the sportsmanship out of the whole execution. Fear of germs, why these fucking pussies? You can't even get a decent hamburger anymore. They cook the shit out of everything now because everybody's afraid of food poisoning. Hey, where's your sense of adventure? Take a fucking chance, will you? You know how many people die from food poisoning every year in this country? 9,000, that's all. It's a minor risk. Huh? Shit. Take a fucking chance, bunch of goddamn pussies. Besides, what do you think you have an immune system for? It's for killing germs. but it needs practice. It needs germs to practice on. So listen. If you kill all the germs around you and live a completely sterile life, then when germs do come along, you're not going to be prepared. And never mind ordinary germs. What are you going to do when some super virus comes along that turns your vital organs into liquid shit? I'll tell you what you're going to do. You're going to get sick, you're going to die, and you're going to deserve it because you're fucking weak and you got a fucking weak immune system. Now, all right, God damn it. I want to tell you a true story about immunization. When I was a little boy in New York City in the 1940s, we swam in the Hudson River, and it was filled with raw sewage.
And that was George Carlin. You Are All Diseased, one of his latest albums. Not bad. Some of the stuff, most of it is sort of lingering buffoonery with lots of poo-poo thrown in, but that's how it goes. Carlin always sounds a little to me like Phil Baer, a kind of, not in content, but in the way his voice goes. For those of you who know activist Phil Baer, frequently heard at the city council, a protester at the peace rallies against the bombing of Yugoslavia, and an advocate of low-income housing for the beach flats against the latest bulldozing plan to destroy the Dolphin Lee apartment buildings. And he'll be talking about that later on the show, we hope. He's standing by. Can't quite get Free Radio Santa Cruz in the beach flats. Apparently he's kind of badly placed for radio, but he will be available by phone. And we'll be talking to him more about our progressive city council's plans regarding low-income housing, whether we can get some real low-income housing instead of another top-down, prefabricated project that gives the plum pieces of the project to favored people and actually results in displacing more people than it serves, and essentially displacing poor people and building housing for those who aren't so poor. We want to make sure that doesn't happen, and looks like we're getting some positive developments along those lines. Well, at the Citizens Police Review Board on Monday, as I said, there was this somewhat historic, but we mustn't be too carried away because the Citizens Police Review Board is pretty powerless, but still, they have the power of public opinion here, and public opinion also had some power over them. And as a consequence of dozens of people at that hearing and at the previous hearing concerned about police misconduct against a political protest, which was a bit rowdy, a bit loud, but certainly not a violent protest. Because of the police misconduct and the subsequent cover-ups that are happening, and cover-ups in our town against the police department take the form of charges against protesters. That's how the police defend their misconduct, by essentially distracting everybody's attention and everybody's energy with charges against the people themselves. And that's something they've done historically and no doubt will continue to do. What we have to do is find the proper tools to make sure that this is turned back on the police department, and the people who are falsely arrested, falsely charged, falsely dragged through the court system, falsely injured, get some kind of mileage out of this in terms of making real changes in the police department, in terms of restitution for themselves and for their community. Because this isn't a good thing to have happening in a community. Not only is it a bad thing to see your friends getting beaten up or falsely arrested, it intimidates you when you see that, and you keep your voice a little more quiet, or it's a little harder to raise your voice when that happens. And that's really a bad thing on a social level for that to happen. And I think that that's really the value of careful monitoring of the police department. That's really the value of people doing a cop watch, keeping their eyes on where police are selectively harassing poor people or people of different skin colors or people who are young because they're ignorant of their rights. It's really important that the community take action. And of course, then there's the whole issue of whether there aren't alternate modes of community involvement other than the police that can be used to deal with problems that arise in the community. I mean, before Scott Kennedy sent armed police into the Resource Center for Nonviolence, I mean, before he involved himself with the COPS program, the federal program involving the drug war, and indeed that is about what? Is it 50% or is it 75% of police work? I don't know, but it's some huge percentage that is corrupting police departments throughout the country, and our own is no exception. I mean, it certainly can't be, you know, it's not that pristine and clean. And when drug money and money to prosecute those who are engaging in victimless crimes that continue goes in huge amounts, it's got to have an effect on how the police department is acting. Maybe we have a call here. I think we may, in fact, be opening up a dialogue on this issue.
Hi, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Well, hi, Robert.
Hey, this sounds like that man about rent control, Bob LaMonica.
Yeah, rent control is very popular. I've never seen anything like it, not since medical marijuana. I will say that. I think it has a very strong chance of making it to ballot. I hope people support it by signing the petition, which is available more and more visibly and, of course, always at the farmer's market. It will be, by the way, consolidated into the March 2000 election. We've got a definitive ruling on that. Because of the way the timeline works out, and that's, I think, all for the best.
So you need about 3,900 signatures, right?
Something like 3,723 qualified to make it to ballot.
And so you're looking for about 5,000 to
about
make sure?
Six. And the petition drive ends November 5th, and the last leg of this will be a major push at UC. And I would say within a month there'll be a rent control button out, maybe even shorter. In a shorter length of time than that. But what I wanted to talk about, what I thought might be interesting, Robert, was this May 22nd so-called police versus protesters event.
Before we square off on that,
Bob,
let's get a phone number people can call if they want to help you with this rent stabilization initiative, which I think is a very important step in the right direction, although I'm always looking for more. We do have a so-called liberal city council and all that. But anyway, what can they do?
Well, if you believe that non-equity dwellers should be provided with regulation, which is what rent control is. Rent stabilization, let me just give this little spool if I could, Robert, but 457-2670. If you want to gather signatures, if you want to sign the petition for rent control here in Santa Cruz, it's a Santa Cruz City measure.
One more time.
457-2670.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over the last 20 years in California, rent control has been watered down, let's say, made much more modest and I think acceptable to any rational person. As it is now, you have protection while you're a tenant, which is to say that when you leave, the unit that you're living in can be brought back up to whatever the landlord perceives market rates to be then. And then it goes back on rent control. This is called vacancy decontrol. This is the major impact of Costa-Hawkins, which was an assembly bill that passed in 1995 and was signed by Wilson.
Kind of
vacancy
gutted rent control.
What's that?
Kind of gutted rent control.
Well, I personally, if I had been an assembly person, I'd have signed it. I think that vacancy decontrol makes sense in that property owners do have rights. There's a balance somewhere that can be struck with this. It's not clear, at least to me, whether or not one of the impacts of Costa-Hawkins is that single-family dwellings, if they don't have an attached rental unit, if there's not two units on the property, for example, single-family dwellings may be exempt from rent control. They are in San Francisco. I've not seen it in Berkeley. This plays out differently in different communities where their ordinances are different for rent control.
Well, this initiative you have is actually an advisory initiative, and does it advise something?
No, the reason why it was not spelled out was so that it could not be attacked on petty grounds, it's a mandate for a rent stabilization board for the regulation of residential rents within the city of Santa Cruz. It would follow the model that they typically all follow, which is you have a rent stabilization board that's elected, right, just like school boards are elected and the port commission's elected and all these jurisdictions have elected boards. The rent stabilization board would be an elected body, whether it's five or seven members can be determined by the city council. The city council will ultimately shape this, and I'm sure the city attorney and the like. It would be based on the models that exist, which are basically a rent stabilization board that has two main functions. One is they provide for an annual rate adjustment, which is the maximum that rents can be raised in all regulated units within the jurisdiction. Now, in Berkeley this year, it was 1% or $8, whichever's less, meaning if your rent was $800 or more, it could only be raised $8. That's very different from Santa Cruz 1999, where rent increases of 50% are becoming very, very common.
Wow.
And we're losing the context. What the fact of the matter is that somebody's going to flip hamburgers at Jack's, and we're not going to all become internet millionaires, okay? These are hardcore realities. And there aren't too many things that are more basic than housing. Nobody complains about Cal-Am water being regulated, right? They don't get to charge whatever they want for water. These things have been common practice for a long time, and that we would find housing and rentals to be such a hot potato, sacrosanct, can't even discuss it without one being labeled a commie or something. It's really absurd. I think that the wave is with rent control here in Santa Cruz, and I feel very confident that it's going to not only make it to ballot, but also achieve success at the ballot and be implemented. But the two functions of rent control, you have an annual rent adjustment, and landlords and tenants can petition for individual rate adjustments. So, for example, if there are capital improvements on the property, the landlord can petition for an individual rate adjustment. So there are those two main functions of a rent stabilization board.
And again, the number for someone to call.
Want to get involved, 457-2670. You ever want to connect with it at the farmer's market every Wednesday downtown Santa Cruz. There's also an open meeting every 3 p.m. Saturday at Java House. Downtown Santa Cruz, 120 Union, if you want to pick up petitions or get involved. So Saturday at 3 p.m., Java House, open meeting. Farmers Market, you always see a little stand there, you should, for rent control. And 457-2670.
Well, those are really dramatic stats, Bob, about the comparative rent increases from Berkeley of 1% to our own 50%.
I mean, Berkeley was prudent enough and had the political will enough to grab the wave of rent control 20 years ago. Now, Santa Cruz made three attempts at this, and I have the three ballot measures, right? In two cases, if my memory is correct, they were initiative ordinances, and the third one, it was a charter amendment.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but they would have all achieved the same goal, a rent stabilization board with the authority to regulate residential rents. I think there are 17 communities in California with rent control now. There are calls that come in regularly about, you know, what about for the county of Santa Cruz? Well, to the best of my knowledge, it's never been done on a county level, with the exception of San Francisco, which is a city-county jurisdiction. And it would be a very, very different process entirely. But there is a track record for successful, implementable rent control within municipalities in California. So what we're doing here in Santa Cruz is based upon a 20-year track record of what has to be called success. In many, many communities up and down the state of California. And rent control has been challenged from the start by of course, enormous vested interests that want to claim that their property rights are not based upon public law, in my opinion, right? That they have the right to disconnect a human being from their dwelling, because they don't own it. To me, rent control is a no-brainer in 1999. I'll give an example, a middle-class example. A couple with a kid, they're living in an apartment, they're paying $1,500 a month, they're probably paying, on the average, 40 to 60% of their income for rent, and overnight the rent gets jacked up 50%. Forgive my language being a little loose, but these are common realities here in our burg.
Mm-hmm.
And what do? Well, they either bite the bullet and really reduce their lifestyle, maybe even go without a car, which might be what people want from one angle, but they reduce themselves down to maybe even food stamps in order to pay their rent, or they move into a much more substandard dwelling, or they move out of the area.
Sure, or they move onto the streets and subject themselves to the sleeping ban.
Yes. Okay. So here we are, and what the housing industry will claim with their PR spin on it And they'll use the term affordable housing, right, which is, of course, a buzz phrase for subsidized housing, that the housing industry should not be held accountable for affordable housing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in essence, then who should? Well, then, obviously, the only option left is the state. So the state becomes the repository of all those that can't afford to play the game of we're independent entrepreneurial capitalists. To me, it's a sham, Robert. In 1999, this is a major issue. Are we truly willing to accept a two-tiered reality where the poor and the lower middle class are subsidized so that the ownership of the and I'm going to use some Marxist language here on Free Radio, of the petty bourgeois shops in Santa Cruz can pretend that they're entrepreneur capitalists as they live in their houses on hills and drive around in Volvos. So to me, it's pretty disgusting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are a lot of people who probably agree with you, though. I guess one of the reasons that I was told that rent stabilization or control failed in the late 70s and early 80s has to do with the kind of low proportion of renters vis-a-vis owners. Do you have any sense
well,
on that?
Well, 53% renters in Santa Cruz, but this homeowner apathy, people, and this is what I think has changed. I think that people realize more so now than ever that there is a social reality, that the town would collapse without the $8 worker, and what are you going to do? Bus them in from Watsonville? I mean, if we're talking about practical realities, the only next step is, like I've expressed before, as far as I'm concerned, is that we just simply accept two-tiered economy, and we allow the lower classes to be subsidized and shipped in from Watsonville to work at the boardwalk and work at the shops on Pacific Avenue, and we pretend. Or we address the fact that regulation has been used in virtually every industry that exists. In fact, I can't think of an industry that isn't regulated, with the exception of rents.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, well, here is a utilization for government that is other than pandering to the wealthy.
You know how Canada handles this?
There's a pocket in Canada that has rent control. It's around from Ottawa to Toronto. Ottawa to Hamilton, I believe. There are pockets of rent control. New York City has had rent control for years. There's a pocket in northern New Jersey with rent control.
Mm-hmm.
So there are pockets where this has caught on,
mm-hmm.
right? But it has been resisted by, I would assume, ultimately the same lobbying forces that provided homeowners with mortgage interest deductions.
You know, I think, Bob, last show on Sunday, because I wasn't here on Thursday, I talked with several activists, Marcia and Allison, who were very disappointed with the SCAN-run conference out of Cabrillo College and wanted to set up their own conference for real activists concerned with pressing real issues rather than simply schmoozing and providing empire-building prospects for existing SCAN politicians. And I think that this rent control issue is really a very important one that should be a part of that potential conference which people are talking about holding in August. Would you be up for that?
Well, as I know I've expressed on your show in the past and with you on a personal level, Robert, I have never seen, certainly in the decade of the 90s, SCAN take anything resembling a leadership position on anything that would be called a difficult issue.
That's
exciting issue.
That's right. We need an alternate conference.
So my own inclination is not towards quasi-political parties, which is basically what SCAN is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's the way that human beings naturally come together politically. I think we come together politically on coalitions for specific issues and coalitions for specific candidates. And so to me, the we believe, I'm a whatever, right, is just too bogus for me. And although what it does represent is a quick fix political numbers clout, and that's why people are attracted to political parties.
I don't think I'm talking about a political party. I'm talking more about a conference on issues, and I think this issue is really an important one.
Here's the conflict. There's nothing wrong with becoming necessarily established, as far as I could figure out, and there's nothing wrong with having a collective impact with your establishment perspective. So I don't think there's anything wrong with what SCAN does. I don't think you could really... I'm not sure whether you could challenge
that. No, I think you misunderstand me. I'm not talking about SCAN. I'm talking about those of us who felt that SCAN didn't deal with the issues such as rent control, such as civil rights in Santa Cruz, such as the sleeping ban,
there's child care. I think what I would introduce here would be the word credibility. You see, the only way that you would ever be able to displace what SCAN has achieved by default for 20 years, which is that we represent progressivism.
Well, again, I don't think we're trying to do that.
Is to become more credible than that.
Well, Bob, we're not trying to really displace them. I mean, what I'm talking about is a conference where certain issues would be raised simply by people concerned about those issues, not necessarily setting in terms of long-term organizational party.
Political tactics and strategizing. I think, to me, you do it. It's like rent control. And I don't want to sound too whatever. Maybe I don't even... Today's the 4th of July, okay? But basically, you know, you do it. You can do polls until you roll over, okay? You can have task forces until the millennium bug hits. I don't know. Way beyond that. We can do endless task forces, endless polls, and then eventually you do something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're only going to play your safe cards, well, then you're really not much of a... As far as I'm concerned, there's very little enthusiasm and excitement, and it doesn't interest me. Okay, so I look at it, you know, from my own perspective. What interests me politically are those things that have a visionary teaching message to them. And I think rent control I thought about for about a year, okay? And to really lay it out openly, and I think it's, why not, okay, it was not going to come up through the established channels of the progressive entrenched left and I'm not anti-established left in this town. They do some good things, and there are some of the key players that I think are really special. But in the case of certainly of rent control, that they weren't going to pick it up, and maybe it was a 20-year ago thing for them. But what I will say is that when rent control came out, it was immediately picked up by the media, and it is perceived possible that what happens here in Santa Cruz could launch a new wave of rent control.
We're talking to Bob LaMonica, who works with Linda LeMaster and David Silva on the rent control initiative, the rent stabilization initiative, which he is seeking to get voters' signatures for in the city of Santa Cruz. Again, his number is...
457-267. That's Rent Control Santa Cruz, if you want to get involved. Rent, fun issue, too, by the way. One of the few two-word issues. All you got to say is rent control,
mm-hmm.
and people know. Okay, so it's on a good wave, and as I think I expressed when I first got on the air, I've never seen anything like it since medical marijuana, where you could say two words and people would pretty much go towards it. There are, of course, those that resist it, but that's what makes it an issue.
Anything further you wanted to talk about?
Well, I did. I originally wanted to call to bring up this so-called police versus protesters event on the 22nd of May,
mm-hmm.
And to get some hardcore definitions. Now, was it civil disobedience?
No, I wouldn't say so. At least not from my impression, my perspective.
Was it a peaceful protest?
Yes.
Was it disturbing the peace?
No one has been charged with disturbing the peace.
Was it disrupting a public meeting?
No one has been charged with disrupting a public meeting.
What was the complaint based on that engaged the police?
There was a complaint from a member in the McPherson Center that a boombox playing sounds of the bombing in Yugoslavia was being played too loud. And the woman who owned the boombox explained that had anyone come up to her and asked her to turn it down, particularly a police officer, she would have been happy to do so. But that's not what the police did. They instead seized the boombox, seized another person who they claimed had been associated with the boombox, marched her off, or actually dragged her off to the paddy wagon, alarming all the protesters. And in response, the protesters surrounded the paddy wagon and wanted to know what the charges were. After which, numerous other things happened as well. Police officers, one police officer, David Lefebvre, singled out a couple, each of whom had a child on their shoulders, and began to drag them off as the children were screaming. And this prompted one of the protesters, Steve Argue, to punch a police officer in the face in order to allow this woman to get away. which apparently was successful. Another man was arrested when he put his arm on a police officer's arm in a non-violent but forceful way, which allowed the other man with his child to get away. And that was pretty much it. Another man, Vinny, was arrested for, he was tape recording, and they claimed he was obstructing the situation. But since I'm skeptical of that, because I saw most of what he was doing, it didn't look obstructive to me. And there were a lot of, the police essentially to me prompted a lot of bad reactions from the crowd.
The chronology that you're reacting to, that you're saying puts the police in culpability, is that they, based upon a complaint.
It was bad police work, I think.
Based upon a complaint,
yeah.
They overreact. What they could have, should have, which was to make a request.
They should have announced that they felt that this was too loud. Would the people who were doing it please turn down the boombox? Or if they didn't like the people banging on the window, and people were...
Banging on the window.
People were banging on the window. The police at no time made any attempt to do anything about this at all, so it was kind of...
You see, the story unfolds.
Yeah.
Okay, now banging on a window is not disturbing the peace?
Well, the police didn't charge anybody with disturbing the peace.
Is not disrupting. These were not charges.
Well, they didn't look like
a public meeting.
They didn't look like, no, they weren't charged with any of that.
And you're saying this was a peaceful protest?
Yeah.
Though.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then therefore, if I've got you...
Let me put it this way. It was a noisy, peaceful protest.
A noisy, peaceful protest.
Yes.
Peaceful includes banging on windows, therefore.
Mm-hmm.
Blaring a boombox to where one has to shout to be heard?
Well, now you see, I don't know, because I assume that wasn't the case, because inside I saw people conversing normally. I saw speakers speaking. There was no indication that they'd stopped anything to go, you know, waiting for the police to do something. They continued their business as usual indoors. So I'm assuming they were pretty well insulated inside.
If you and I were at a meeting,
mm-hmm.
and we were conducting our affairs, or trying to, and someone started to bang on the windows.
Mm-hmm.
What would you think about that?
Well, of course, I'd have to be inside. I might find it rather shocking.
Would you want something done?
It would depend on the circumstances, but I would certainly, you know, I don't know. I would have to be sitting inside
you
there.
See, here's where it gets me. Okay, disobedience?
You know,
no, you're saying this is not civil disobedience. There's a reason why you're saying that.
Well, civil disobedience means where you're specifically violating a law,
yes.
in order to challenge
okay.
the law.
Was it a peaceful protest? You're saying yes.
Noisy but peaceful.
Okay, noisy but peaceful. That's a very, you see, selectively. So you've identified that it was extremely noisy. Not only noisy, but banging on windows is a certain amount of physical violence, would you not say?
It depends on how sturdy the windows are and whether there's any real apprehension of it.
Would you call this kind of behavior polite?
Oh, I wouldn't say it was polite.
Do you think that it achieved anything, really, to communicate the issue to more than
definitely
the people
it prompted FAR to hold the long-awaited town hall meeting. I think, in fact, it prompted them to come out and speak to the crowd.
You brought this up before, that was the prompt, and I tend to agree with you, that was the prompt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, whether that prompt could have been achieved in a different
well, we tried. We tried sitting in his office twice peacefully. We tried endless letters. We tried petitions. I mean, we did try a number of things first.
Well, now, if then I would have then a goal, a measurable goal of this protest, then peaceful protest was the
noisy but peaceful.
Noisy but peaceful protest,
yeah.
according to you.
Yeah.
Which was not civil disobedience, by
no,
the way.
No, no, not civil disobedience.
Was the, what day was that? June 1st?
Yeah.
Civic?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Whatever you want to call that.
There was a kind of a big, there was
there was
shindig
a
at the Civic.
Okay, yeah. All right. So that was the goal. Therefore, what you're saying too is that we weren't achieving.
Well, actually, that wasn't really the. I mean, that was one of the goals.
Well, okay.
The Representative Farr is the federal representative,
yeah.
here in the area, and he has voted on 4 successive occasions for more bombs, including uranium depleted weapons, cluster bombs, all kinds of weapons of mass destruction.
Well, now if I've got it correct, Sam Farr is the elected representative from the 17th Congressional District of which we're residents.
This is true. And we are his constituents.
And what are the alternatives? Does that sound far enough?
We could run you,
right?
Bob. I mean, you might be a better alternative at this point, I'll tell you.
Well, I'm not a fan of Sam Farr's. In fact, I Sam Farr, you ever seen him on TV when he reads from his teleprompter announcing his? In fact, the way that he announced that he was going to have this Civic, the event at the Civic, did you see that on TV? It was so corny. He looks right into the person that's
holding the. Yeah, I don't have a TV, but I believe
the script. What do you expect? Okay, this is the type of politics that you can put most of them into the same category. What would you really expect from Dianne Feinstein or Barbara Boxer, or you name it?
Well,
I think more from Sam Farr than what you get, which is essentially a very mainstream established.
Well, you know what Susan B. Anthony always
hack.
Said. Susan B. Anthony always said
is not realistic.
Demand the impossible.
Well, you and I agree on that. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And also raise the issues and accept.
We were asking a number of things from Farr, but the one thing that we still haven't gotten, and it's now 2 months later, nearly, is we asked him for an answer to 10 questions, and they were relatively simple questions about the war. Did he favor, as I mentioned, the uranium-depleted weapons? Did he feel that the war violated the U.S. Constitution? Did he feel it violated the U.N. Charter? And in other words, a series of specifics.
Well, so you were petitioning for a redress of grievances. Now, here's the thing that gets me, has gotten me all on. About the tactic that's utilized and justified, these are not civil disobedience acts, as I understand it from you, Robert,
mm-hmm.
Is that the tactics are not what one would call within the realm of discreet, within the realm of anything resembling politeness. When one looks back on the films from the 60s, the sit-ins at the counters and the like, these were very, very impeccable protesters. And they called themselves protesters, and they engaged in civil disobedience.
Well, then there are other kinds of protesters, too, that also, I think, had an important part in the civil rights struggle that were not... I think the Watts riots, for example, resulted in there being all kinds of massive infusions of urban aid into the central cities that Martin Luther King couldn't get. I mean, I'm a big fan of the Watts riots.
Have you ever
riots.
Seen the gutted out ruins of most of the older northern eastern cities from the days of the big spending for inner city housing? They're all gutted out ruins.
Well, I don't know. Somewhere along the line, some of that money probably helped some people, and it wouldn't have been there if people hadn't raised their voices to do it.
Tactic. I raise the issue of the tactic.
Well,
what I perceive in our town here of Santa Cruz with that tactic is that I am not convinced that it really produced an outcome that one could say you could get behind.
Well, I understand.
I think the problem with that protest on May 22nd is that it's very difficult to get support because the activity was nauseous.
Well, I understand, Bob.
You
have
call
this
it
perspective.
Noisy? I think it was nauseous.
Well, I was more nauseated by what they were doing over in Yugoslavia, but maybe that's just me. I do have a problem. I'm running into a kind of a time crunch here.
Well, thanks for letting me get on the air, Robert.
Yeah, thank
and
you,
happy
Bob.
Happy 4th of July.
All right.
And we all have the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
We hope that...
And Sam Farr is our elected representative.
Uh-huh. Okie doke. Well, we'll keep that in mind, and hopefully you'll have some major impact on him. Thanks
a lot,
Bob.
Robert.
We are back here, 96.3 FM. Phone line is open, 427-3772. I'm Robert Norris. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. And let's hear a little music, but please join in this conversation if you'd like to. We're going to be talking about a number of things today, as you hear. The subject matter ranges from rent control through what is proper protesting protocol to You name it. Of course, I have a number of topics that are always a favorite of mine, and I'll be getting into some of those later. Let's take a musical break.
If you can't be careful, try to be good. Well, we cared and we cared as much as we could. We always agreed, me and my man, said someday we'll try the family plan. The first thing we tried was nothing at all, because the amateur ride and everything's here for. We charted my times, followed my mood, but then someday came a little too soon. We got the 9 months of blues. Too much to gain, too much to lose. But he was kind of happy when he heard my news. I got the 9 months of blues. Oh, there was him and me and the baby made three. But we made up our mind and she stood that way. With little bit of things made of rubber and such. And cause we were friends, we decided to go Dutch. And when we said I do, it was a solemn oath. So we did and we did and it pleased us both. We still can't figure out what went wrong. That's the first line of the 9 months song. We got the 9 months blues. Too much to gain, too much to lose. Get out the dress and the sensible shoes. We got the 9 months blues. I said this time around I'm gonna cast my stone. I'm gonna have a chance to call my life my own. About the SPC, the FDA, they said to keep that child, don't fling it away. The doctor said he had the right to refuse. The law says if you want to beat the noose, you gotta be rich, a meteor grade. So away I went again on the 9 month rail about the 9